The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly Extra, lockdown episode 3. On today's pod, we'll talk to Philippe Auclair about his life and times. Barry is in his house, I'm in my house. Barry, what news from Glendenning Towers?
There's not a great deal of news, really. I've been watching a lot of television. I've watched all of Tiger King, which is arguably the most bonkers documentary I've ever seen in my life. I can't recommend it highly enough. Just when you think it can't get more weird, it does. Continuing to eat well, trying to do a bit of exercise. And I'm still relatively sane. I have to say, I had a bit of a wobble, I think, on, was it Tuesday? Yeah, because Tuesday was the first day I had a day off. I had no work to do. And so I had nothing really to focus on and that or to build my day around. So that was a bit odd. But apart from that, it's all good. Yourself?
I think it's just only occasionally when you realise how long this might go on for that I sort of think, oh, this really is, this is a real, you know, this is a weird, real thing that is not going to end anytime soon. But sort of minute to minute, day to day, I think I'm okay. I can show you the exercise bike that I panic bought and have managed to build and have yet to ride on. And I imagine it'll become quite an expensive clothes horse. Now, we had two messages. Jim said, well, we had more than two, but on the subject of the part one last pod, Jim said, 5 minutes into the pod and I'm doing egg impressions. I've now come to the realization I'm not going to make it through this crisis. And Steve says, during the pod, I quizzed my wife on the sound of eggs. On her very first attempt, she was far more convincing than either Max or Barry. Your probably the best in the world comment was completely out of line. If you'd like to organize a sound of eggs off, just let us know. Listen, it may get to that. We've got a big ideas board and listeners doing the sound of eggs. I am on board with that. Barry, we're about to speak to Philippe Auclair. What are you? Producer Jonathan shakes his head at the sound of eggs pod idea. Just open your mind, Jonathan. We're about
Nothing
to speak to
Philippe. Nothing is off the table.
Exactly. What are you most looking forward to finding out about Philippe Auclair?
Well, I don't know a huge amount. I'm aware he's first and foremost a musician, but I've never been to one of his gigs and I've never heard any of his music, so I'm interested in hearing more about that. I mean, Philippe's top bloke, very interesting guy, and yeah, it'll just be interesting to see where the conversation takes us, I suppose. I don't know anything about his upbringing. You know, I imagine he spent his years, I have this image of him in a stripy t-shirt and a beret with the stereotypical string of garlic or onions around his neck. So I'm looking forward to him busting that mental image I have. But, it's important to know these things.
Right, let's get on with it. After the break, the life and times of Philippe Auclair. So welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra, the life and times of Philippe Auclair, Barry. And for that, we're going to need Philippe Auclair, aren't we?
Well, yes. I'm interested to find out if these rumours that he's not actually French are true and was born and reared in Croydon.
Philippe, can you confirm or deny it? It's a very tough first question to face from Glendenning. But
I deny. I was not born in Croydon, I'm afraid. Sorry, Barry. This rumor, I won't tell you where I was born, though. But this particular rumor is not founded.
First of all, Philippe, how are you finding everything?
It's strange, but I'm keeping very busy with a number of things. A lot of work, investigative work. Working with the Football Writers Association and the Sports Journalists Association, trying to keep the everybody together, trying to help the people who need help, finding loads of things, spending more time on the exercise bike at home than I've ever done, probably. So I'll be much fitter when I next see you at Guardian HQ, which is good. And basically, surprising myself by not doing too badly, really. which means only doing badly a few hours a day.
Let's start at the beginning then. I have born in Normandy on the 24th of June 1959, Philippe. What is your first recollection of football?
Wow. Probably watching a game in which one of my older friends was playing in Fréville, so about 4 or 5 miles from the farm, the family farm, and going on a Saturday and watching my friend play with the young ones. That's my earliest memory. As for my earliest proper game, I have no idea. I was thinking about it, and I think most people have got kind of imagined memories of that.
Mm.
You know what I mean? So that I think I remember when Nobby Styles broke the leg of Seymour in the game in 1966. But I think that is an implanted memory. I think this is one, kind of Blade Runner kind of memory. So I'm actually, it makes me quite anxious, because it's a memory in black and white, which means I probably saw the footage so many times that I think, oh yeah, I remember that. In fact, I don't.
Can you remember the first time you thought that football had like an emotional hold over you?
I think it's through playing rather than watching, because there were hardly any games on television at the time to start with. To go and see the games when you lived in the middle of the countryside, as I was a bit difficult, apart from the village games. So it was all about being in the schoolyard on gravel and basically enjoying kicking a ball about. So that was it. But I'm talking about really, really early memories here. Sure. I was 5 years old, 6 years old, something like that. And I didn't go to a proper game of football until much, much later.
What kind of player were you, Philippe?
I was a no-nonsense left-back with a good engine. Always was. Technically very poor.
More Andy Hinchcliffe than Roberto Carlos.
Yeah, you could say that again, yeah, absolutely. I would think actually it's really unfair to Andy Hinchcliffe to even talk about it. But it's strange also because my family was not a football family. It was more of a rugger family. And we watched the Five Nations tournaments, everybody was jumping about in the living room, but we didn't really watch any football. And it's only much later that I realized that actually it was because of my mum, because my dad himself had been a really good footballer. And I learned that only a couple of years ago, that he'd played the final of the University French Cup as a left winger. He was a really good footballer. And I had no idea, because football was not the done thing in the family. Terrible, isn't it?
So was football your favourite sport always or not? Or were you more rugby or more...
My favourite game, because there are only, I think, three sports, which are hunting, shooting and fishing. My favourite game is cricket.
How did you get into cricket, Philippe? Was that while you were still in France or when you came over here?
No. It's when I arrived in England, which is 1986. The guy who was the head, the A&R of my record company, L Records, which is part of Cherry Red, was an absolute cricket nutter, a guy called Mike Allway. Absolute genius of an A&R, by the way. And he had all these books about cricket, and he was so obsessed about it that one of the bands on this label was called the Cavaliers, and it was they did a whole album devoted to cricket. And I thought, what is this weird thing that they're so enthused about? So I asked many questions to Mike. He gave me a book. I went to see a county game between Middlesex and Warwickshire on my own, and I sat in the tavern stand, and I was completely smitten. I think it was Wayne Daniel who was bowling that day. And I had no idea that cricket was that fast and furious and dangerous. And I thought, this is perfect for me. This is a game which takes a very long time. It's a mix of slow and quick, which I love. I have time to read my paper, but at the same time, it's very exciting. And I'd found my game. Honestly, it was like love at first sight.
Did you ever have aspirations to work in cricket then, or did you like having cricket as something that isn't a professional pursuit?
I've written a few things about cricket, and actually I think it's one of my, probably will be my obituary. I'm the only Frenchman to have written for Wisden.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I've had pieces published in The Cricketer as well. I remember writing a piece about Abdul Kadir when, you know, very sadly died not that long ago. And various other things, you know. I mean, I've written about cricket, but only as a hobby, I must say. And I would never dream of myself as a cricket writer, Max, honestly. I've done Test Match Sofa, though.
Oh, did you?
I've done Test Match Sofa, yeah.
We had a nice question from Christian who says, was Philippe already known for his notorious ranting against his teachers in primary school and his mother's food, or is it limited to FIFA and UEFA only? What kind of child were you, Philippe Auclair?
I didn't rant against my mother's cooking, who is a marvelous cook, does the best roast chicken in the universe. was a very respectful pupil, but perhaps too respectful. I was very much the kind of pupil who keeps himself to himself and the nose in his books and so forth. So I think I was a very easy child to deal with, much easier as a child than as a grown up.
And what farm did you? What, you know, was it a dairy farm?
It's a fruit farm. We had apples, pears, and we even had peaches and plums and cherries. How sweet is that? Yeah, in Normandy?
It's a really little mini Philippe running around the orchards. Is such a delightful. It's a delightful image. So then, how did you start working in football? Then, was it part of a plan?
No, it wasn't part of a plan at all. It was completely by accident. When I arrived in England, it was strictly for music, absolutely not for football, even though I was an English football fan more than anything, like many people from my part of France who generally tended to look beyond the channel for their football. But I started to work for the BBC World Service back in 87. And at the beginning, it was just doing, you know, news reading and translation work, and then doing a music program, a classical music program as well. And I think at one point I was asked, you know, do you like football? And I said, yeah. Would you like to work at the BBC, do some sports programming? I said, yeah. So I started covering English football for BBC Afrique, which is the French-African service at the BBC at Bush House. And I started to work there and working mostly on the new Premier League. Or actually, it was before the Premier League, because my first games, I think, were when Eric Cantona arrived in England, so 91-92, when he was playing for Leeds United. So, yeah, I arrived in English football the same year as Eric did.
Ari says, can Philippe shine a light on how it was writing the biography and working with Cantona? He says, is he as odd as he appears?
I didn't really work with Eric on the biography because I didn't really want to be drawn into a position where I would be his apostle, acolyte, whatever you would name it. So I wanted to keep my distances with that. But he was aware of the book being written. And I met him on two occasions during the writing. He gave me, how would you call that? He gave me his blessing. Mm-hmm. Up to a point that he allowed me to speak to all of his friends. He never put an obstacle in my way. So he behaved really well, as far as I'm concerned. But I do not know him personally well enough to have any opinion on the man, which sounds strange for somebody who's written a book that's almost 500 pages about him. And my view of Cantona is based on the views of others who know him extremely well. And it's a composite portrait of who he is. Because, you know, you've got to realize with Cantona, you're either with him or against him. And if you're writing a book, this is possibly the worst possible position you can be put in. Do you want to be a Cantonian or an anti-Cantonian? And I didn't want to be either. I just wanted to understand what Cantona was. And so that's a very long and convoluted answer to a very... not simple, but a very short question. I apologize for it.
Philippe, I've always wondered if perhaps this sort of aura and mystique that surrounds Cantona is a bit bogus and he's not quite the enigmatic character we're led to believe. Would I be in any way right?
I think that, yes, in many ways, you are absolutely right. I think there is a tendency to find a mystical quality to his game, his persona, his pronouncements, which is purely fantasy. He becomes, and I think he was very early on, a kind of blank screen on which people could project their own, you know, phantasmagories, basically. And that was already the case in France. Because when you think about it, I mean, he was an exceptional player, a truly exceptional player. He was a very unusual character. But also, what is very unusual about the character is that some of his greatest qualities were not necessarily qualities you would equate with somebody like him, you would feel is self-obsessed and egotist. And he's completely not that. He's a team. He was a team player. He's nowhere as much of a rebel as he pretends to be. And for somebody who sees the world in black and white as he does, there's nobody grayer. So I agree with you. I think there's an awful lot of that mystique. But, you know, I don't want to, you know, this mystique is sorely lacking in the game. So I certainly wouldn't try to. It has its own justification. There is a point where you become something more than you are yourself when you are Eric Cantona. And I think he loves that idea of being Eric Cantona whilst not being Eric Cantona.
You made your pod debut on the 13th of September 2010. You had the first answer about Everton's 3-3 draw with Man United, in which United were 3-1 up in the 91st minute, and then Barney called you Philip. who is the best player you have seen live, Philippe?
Dennis Bergkamp.
You once said you thought that Alfredo Di Stefano was the best player ever. Do you stand by that?
The reason why I said that is because one of the people that I respect the most in our business, in the football, said that to me, and it's Brian Glanville. And I thought, if Brian Glanville thinks that, I think he might have a point. I mean, I've never seen Alfredo Di Stefano play in the flesh, so I couldn't say that, which is why I've always kept away from that. But Brian was absolutely adamant that Alfredo Di Stefano was the greatest player he'd ever seen. And, you know, Brian has seen everybody. So,
is there a player that you think is the best player ever then? If Brian Glanville was never to have had that conversation with you?
I would have said Diego Maradona. I think if you don't love Diego Maradona, you know, you've got a serious problem. And also, I saw the film again two weeks ago, and I thought, oh my God, I love him so much.
When you were working as a journalist, Philippe, was this just something to do, or were you struggling to make ends meet as a musician? Or
yeah, yes, yeah, yeah, exactly. I was struggling to make ends meet. I mean, to be honest, if I were to concentrate on music these days, I would probably struggle far, far more because of all the money that is stolen from us by Spotify and other people like that. But at the time, I was just about eking a living out of music, but not nowhere near enough to have any kind of life, really. It was pretty tough.
What is your musical oeuvre?
Oeuvre?
Yeah.
What is an oeuvre?
Well, an egg. No, like, what's your genre?
Oh, I think my genre is alt pop, I think, or sort of baroque pop. With a jazzy tinge.
Can you describe what baroque pop is?
I think you can probably describe people's music very often by describing their taste in music. So if you think that I'm somebody who loves classical music, and particularly 20th century classical music, who loves jazz, but also loves the Left Bank or the Zombies and the Beach Boys, and was completely bowled over when I discovered Prefab Sprout, which is probably the band that I feel the closest to in terms of the musical language, I think you have a pretty clear idea of where I'm coming from.
Somebody asked you on Twitter to choose between sport and music, and you chose music.
Yeah, I don't even need to think about that.
You told another that you consider yourself a musician before anything else.
Yeah.
Give us an idea of that side of yourself, because I know a lot of listeners only know you as Philippe Auclair, or know that you have this musical side, but don't know any of that journey.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm first and foremost a musician, because I started quite late recording and performing. So I was already in my early 20s, which is quite late, you know, obviously. But I think I'm a studio person. I think that the first time that I found myself in a proper recording studio, I genuinely felt that I was in heaven. This is the place where I wanted to spend my whole life. So maybe this makes me actually quite a good candidate for a lock-in or a lockdown, because it's the cocoon-like atmosphere of the studio. It's the togetherness of the work with the sound engineer and the producer and the other musicians. It's the absolute magic of being able to put some notes together and listen to them and work on them and making it as beautiful as you possibly can. I mean, I don't know. It's just everything for me.
I suppose the writing process in music is more collaborative than the writing process in football writing.
No, not for me. Really? I write entirely on my own. I remember working with Martin Bates of Isles en Gaza. We wrote a few songs together. It was basically he would take care of the lyrics, I would take care of the music. And I have sometimes used the talent of another friend, Jonathan Coe, the novelist, who is a great music lover and an excellent musician himself. And he's written the lyrics to a few of my songs and in the past few years. And I've set some of his texts to music, but that's about it. I would say that probably published about 250 songs, something like that. I would say 240 would be things that I've been doing on my own, completely on my own. The lyrics, the tune, the harmonies, and even the arrangements.
Tell us about the George Best song.
Yeah, the one we played at in Glasgow.
Yeah,
an eternity ago. Even though I'm not a Manchester United fan, my childhood idol, like so many people from my generation, was George Best. And which is absolutely typical of the time because I'd probably never seen George Best play, ever. But it didn't matter because I could see his pictures in France Football. And I loved the way people talked about him and I loved his looks and so forth. So he was my hero, my childhood hero. And at the behest of a friend of mine, Jim Phelan, who's got a label called Exotica in South London. He was putting together an album of homage to George Best. And he said, would you like to write a song? And I said, yeah, absolutely. So I wrote to order, which is very rare for me. And I wrote this song, which is called When Georgie Died, which is actually one of my favorite songs, I think, one of the songs that I'm the proudest of. And I had the chance to play it to George Best himself. Which was very sadly just a couple of months before he died. I did the last interview with George Best. I was the last person to interview him for France Football, because we were planning a big bash in Paris for the 50 years of the Ballon d'Or. And I'd been asked by my editor to be his chaperone for this trip. So I would visit him, talk to him, make sure he was fine. I would travel with him on the train. I would put him up at his hotel. I was going to be his guide for that. And it was, you know, literally 2 months before he went into the Cromwell Hospital. And so I went to visit him in the office that he had with Phil Hughes in Fulham. And he looked really good and he was absolutely wonderful. I mean, never meet your heroes, not in that particular case. He was absolutely wonderful to be with. And so we did this big interview, did a few photographs, and then I had brought a copy of When Georgie Died, and I felt a little bit, obviously, thinking, you know, what about the title? It's a bit, you know, especially in hindsight, my goodness. But he actually liked it very much because the song is not actually such a sad song at all. It's more about the very unusual genius of Georgie Boy. And so I played it to him, and unfortunately I could never I didn't take him to Paris, and I've still got somewhere behind me I've still got his invitation for the evening. And my gosh, when I think about it, I do get a bit emotional, I must say.
Robert says, if Philippe became head of FIFA, what is the first thing he would do?
Probably disband it.
And then what?
And then start from scratch again. Absolutely. What would be my program? I mean, actually, I say that, but there are many things about FIFA which are great in principle. when you think about it, a world body that is dedicated to the good of the game, that gets money, a lot of money, and distributes it to everybody, where the smallest nation has got as much of a voice than the biggest nation, and the powerful don't necessarily grind the weaker to the ground. Except that, of course, FIFA in reality is exactly all that. It's exactly the opposite of rather that of all that. So the idea, I think it's got to a point where the governance in FIFA, but which is valid, I would say, for most of sports actually, because of the gigantism, because of the amount of money which is involved in it, the only way FIFA is ever going to change is from the outside. And because I doubt that anybody who would want to reform that body from the inside would have any chance to go near a position of power. So I think it should be probably disbanded. But I would say the same thing of the IOC. I would say the same thing of most sports organization I can think of.
Does bad corporate behavior in general just affect your enjoyment of football?
Very much so. It affects it to the point that, like many people, I've been asking myself the question, is it time to switch off? Which, of course, would be, given my situation and present career, perhaps not the greatest of choices. But certainly, it has changed the way I write about the game. It has changed my enjoyment of the game. And I think many fans feel the same way, which is one of the reasons why what is happening at the moment, where suddenly we have got this stark reminder of what reality truly is, will have an absolutely huge impact. I certainly hope so, in the way in our relationship with the game we love and the organization we don't love so much. So yes, it has had a huge impact, Max. But I think I'm like almost every single football fan I can think of.
Do you think football will look different when this is done?
Yeah, I think. I mean, first of all, the economics of the game are going to be will have to change drastically because I'm still amazed that we're hearing various federations, confederations telling us, our plan is to resume at this date. Our plan is to do this. This is ridiculous. It's not going to happen. We all know it. It's at the moment, it's basically trying to feed a kind of buy time, as it were, because there are so many things which are at stake, economically speaking. And the economic consequences on what is happening on football are going to be absolutely colossal at every single level of the game. So it's fairly obvious to me, and I think it is to most people, that, for example, the transfer market is going to go through the floor, that the values of player is going to go through the floor, that the broadcasting rights are going to go down, 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 and basically that money is going to exit the game at a rate of knots. And that in itself will be enough to change it. Because you'll have to. I mean, and I can't see how this could not be the case. I genuinely cannot see that when you will be working in depressed economies, and no matter how much bread and how much circuses we need, the fact is the finances of football were already in a state where they were not sustainable in the long term. And therefore, we have football was already in a bad way, financially speaking, economically speaking. Because of that, a number of clubs are going to go into administration. Or if they don't go into administration, it's because a solidarity system will have been put in place, which is what I hope that will go some way towards, and maybe I'm talking like John Nicholson and a bit of a utopia here, but that you will have a solidarity system, which I hope to see in society at large as well, but also apply to football, where the era of the super elite, which could completely forget about everybody else, will be over. That's my great hope. And so how it cannot change radically, I don't know. I mean, I think it's an impossibility for it not to change absolutely radically.
Some quick fire questions for you, Philippe.
Okay.
On the list of jobs you've had, we've got chef, philosophy teacher, mm-hmm. mushroom collector, board yep. game inventor. Is there anything you haven't done you would like to do?
I would love to find out if I could paint or not. There you go.
I mean, you have time now. How many mushrooms do you need to have collected to officially be a mushroom collector?
I think about a couple of boxes that you can put at the back of the deux chevaux and bring to the local restaurants. That qualifies you as a professional mushroom collector.
What was the board game?
The board game was called Le Connaisseur. And the idea was that it was all about trivia. All the questions were about food and wine. All of the questions. At the beginning of the game, you were given a recipe to complete, okay? You had to have a list of ingredients. And when you answered the questions properly, you picked up a card, an ingredients card, which is not stupid, isn't it?
No,
and there were loads.
Like
Yeah. It was a board game. And of course, the board was like a dining table with 24 plates. So you moved from plate to plate.
And what were the counters? Were you like a fork or a knife or a spoon?
No, there were little bottles.
Oh, right. Okay, good.
There were little bottles. And so we had questions which were about, some would be about food and literature, or some of them were just about food, others were about wine and so forth. And we actually found somebody who was willing to take it on. But the game was never manufactured, unfortunately, because they were looking to get a big sponsor and they couldn't get that. And this was the beginning and the end of my life as an inventor of board games.
Now, Barry and I once went to Pizza Express, and after ordering our pizzas, Barry, when asked if he wanted a drink, he just said, "Loads of red wine, please," which was my favourite way to ever order wine. I suspect you might take more care over such an order, Philippe. What is your favourite wine?
My favourite wine, which of course I can't afford, is a wine from the Loire Valley called Clos Rougeard. Rougeard, which I've tasted 3 times in my life, and I'm very, very lucky to have done that, because it is a very, very difficult wine to get hold of. It is a Saumur Champigny. Unfortunately, the growers have sold that to a different owner, but anything that is pre, I would say, 2013, go for it, guys. This is the greatest wine on the planet. I'm not joking. It's better than any Grand Cru you can think of. It's better than any Burgundy that you can think of.
How much is a bottle?
It used to be quite cheap. It's now probably about 600 quid a bottle, something like that. It's still cheaper than Romane Conti or all of this nonsense. I never bought one. Unfortunately, one of my closest friends is used to run a wine bar in Shepherd's Bush, and went to and visited Clos Rougeard on a couple of occasions when the bottles were not at 600 quid, but you know, a pop, but about 20 euros. And so he's got some stock. Lucky man.
I was once lucky enough to have a glass of wine from a bottle that cost 1,000 euros. And I'm hopeless at remembering the names of wine, so I can't remember what it was. But it was very nice, but it didn't seem like a huge amount nicer than, say, a 20 euros bottle of wine or a 20 quid bottle of wine. So, but I'm a bit of a Philistine. But
it's not being a Philistine. I think it's a question of getting to, it's a bit like saying that, you know, it's like comparing Oasis and the Beatles, basically.
Yeah, I suppose.
I'm not an Oasis fan. I think you've understood that. So I don't dislike them, but there's, the difference in quality is not—it's not quite the same, I must say. And it's—I don't know, Barry. Maybe we should have a couple of bottles together. Yeah. And you know,
when this is all over,
when this is all over, and this is going to be such a party, absolutely.
Finally, Philippe, listeners will probably know that you are the French voice of EasyJet.
I am.
Can you finish this part with that word said twice, please?
Brace. Brace.
We'll be back in a minute. Welcome to part 3 of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Just to update you on the latest happenings because of COVID-19. UEFA had a meeting yesterday during which they decided to call off June's international fixtures, including the Euro 2020 playoffs, and to postpone the Champions League and Europa League until further notice. The under-17 men's Euros, the under-19s women's Euros have been cancelled, other tournaments postponed until further noticed. They've postponed deadlines for player registrations and qualification to next season's competition also until further notice. Furloughing is sort of the big story coming out of the Premier League at the moment. On Monday, Newcastle became the first club to furlough their staff. Spurs have announced that their 550 non-playing staff will take a 20% pay cut for the next 2 months and be put on furlough through the British government's coronavirus job retention scheme. Just for perspective, owner Joe Lewis is worth $4.358 billion. If the average earner at Spurs was on $30,000 a year, only an example, it's more likely lower than that, then the total saving of the pay cut in those 2 months would be £550,000, or 0.012% of his fortune. It's 3.6% of Jose Mourinho's yearly salary, 3 weeks' wages for top earners Harry Kane or Tanguy Ndombele. And Daniel Levy announced it on the same day that his 2018-19 salary was announced at £7 million, including a £3 million bonus earned on completion of the new stadium. Philippe, what do you think?
I think you would need to redact every single word that I could possibly use reacting to that. I think it's a shocking disgrace. I think it's beyond awfulness. It's people showing their true colours. And maybe what I will say, because I think we all feel the same about it, is that the response I've had, heard from friends of mine who are Spurs supporters and, you know, proper supporters, they are all also disgusted by this. I don't know what to say, to be honest. It's unforgivable. Unforgivable.
As far as the furloughing is concerned, I mean, everyone's an expert in furloughing now. It's a word I'd never heard before 2 weeks ago, I have to confess. It speaks volumes, I suppose, that Leeds are leading the way in this. Leeds are traditionally a really unpopular team, apart from their huge fan base. And their PR in the last two seasons is just... it's been an incredible turnaround that, you know, Marcelo Bielsa, everyone loves them, everyone wants to get them to get promoted because Marcelo Bielsa is in charge. And now their captain, Liam Cooper, has stood up and acted like a leader. And that the team have deferred their wages so that all their staff can get paid. I can't think of any other team who's done this and led the way like this.
I think Stephen Naismith was the first one, and the Hearts were the first to actually do that. Stephen Naismith published a statement last Sunday in which he said he'd taken a 50% pay cut and that the money would go to protect the most vulnerable and less well-paid members of staff. So I think Hearts were number one in this, and deserving of their name.
Right, I was unaware of that, but hats off to him too.
A few teams are already talking about pay cuts. Eddie Howe and three other senior employees at Bournemouth have taken significant voluntary pay cut, but they have put 50 staff on furlough. They will pay the difference so they don't lose money, those 50. Birmingham City have asked players who are earning more than £6,000 a week to take a 50% pay cut. There are stories of pay cut agreements reached at Barcelona, Borussia Dortmund, Bayern Munich, Juventus. In a meeting on Wednesday, the PFA's Gordon Taylor expressed the players' union's preference for a wage deferral rather than a cut, meaning that players will be paid the money back by the club before the end of their contracts. But the Premier League is said to favour the cut. Talks are ongoing for another 2 days.
In PFA chief Gordon Taylor, we've the highest paid union official in the world and arguably one of the worst. And he's going to have to earn his corn now, I think. And it's not very often he stands up to the Premier League, but he appears to be doing it now. And it's be interesting to see what happens. People are saying that the players should volunteer to take pay cuts, and I'm not entirely comfortable with players constantly be singled out as the ones who should suffer. It's almost as if, you know, a lot of them are working class kids who've done very well for themselves, and people seem to have a problem with a lot of these working class kids earning ridiculous amounts of money. I don't. You get paid what you're worth, or what people are willing to pay for you. But it would be nice of them to offer to defer their wages or just take a pay cut. They don't need all that money they're getting, presumably. Some of them might, I don't know, but...
A fascinating story from Sweden. A club in the seventh tier of Swedish football, which is carrying on at the moment, has had to cancel a friendly for the safety of their players after members of the squad and coaching staff were contacted by people from all over the world who'd either placed bets on their last game or about to place bets on the upcoming match, with some messages threatening in nature. It's the extraordinary capacity of people desperate to gamble on any sport that might be taking place at this moment. And Philippe, you're working on an investigation into a story in Ukraine.
I wouldn't say I'm working on an investigation. I'm trying to find out more about it and see if it's worthy of an investigation. But there was this very, very strange thing which happened over the weekend when was put to betting agencies and companies that there would be some a kind of friendly round robin football tournament called the Azov Cup, which would pit against each other a few teams from the Ukrainian second division, and it looked, you know, quite. I mean, it looked like it was really going to take place, and there were like team sheets being distributed. I mean, postings on the Facebook pages purporting to come from those clubs. And so those games were actually put out to the you know, the gamblers during the weekend. And actually, and that's what I'm investigating at the moment. I'm trying to find out exactly how much money was put on that. And the first indication is that apparently at least between 1 and 2 million euros were bet on those games. And that's, which is quite crazy. Because these games never took place. These games didn't exist. They were a fabrication by criminals, it seems. And it doesn't seem either that the clubs were aware of what was going on, the clubs which were supposed to take part in that. And so this is, you know, we've got to ascertain who managed to fool everybody into believing that this friendly tournament would take place behind closed doors. But there's absolutely no doubt that the people at the bottom of it were people who were trying to swindle money out of... out of the betting industry, and also people were willing to believe in. This is absolutely dreadful.
You should check out Nick Ames' piece about the situation in Nicaragua. They're still one of three countries still playing football, Belarus and Burundi, the other two. Diriangan, who are third, don't want to play. They were outvoted at a meeting of the clubs. They're the only club in the league not owned or funded by the state, who are desperate to maintain the appearance of normality. Fascinating story. In the past week, French football has lost two icons of the game, Michel Hidalgo and Pape Diouf. For anyone who isn't aware of those two figures, what do they mean to you?
An awful lot. Michel Hidalgo, of course, is the manager who gave France its first international trophy at the Euro 1984. Is the man who was inseparable from this fabulous generation of French players with the Platinis and Giresse and Jean Tigana and all the others, and Luis Fernandez and Bernard Changini and so forth. And he was the man who supervised this wonderful French national team and also encouraged it to play the kind of football that made it, I think, probably the neutral's favorite team at the world in the world at the time. And he was also a very kind, very generous man. And it's been a major shock. And then just after that, another huge shock, which is the death from COVID-19 at the age of 68, the first casualty in Senegal, by the way, of the Franco-Senegalese Pape Diouf, who was a journalist at La Provence, who was an agent of some very big players in the south of France, in Marseille in particular, and then the chairman of Olympique de Marseille, but much, much more than that, and also a moral authority and an absolute rock and a person who mattered so much for us in French and African football. And there was something which was said, which will give you an idea of how important he was and will remain. Is a quote from an African, French-African friend of mine from Senegal, who said, quoting actually a Senegalese writer, said, when a man dies, it's as if a book had been burned. He said, when somebody like Pape Diouf dies, it's as if a whole library had burned down. And I think that gives you an idea of the kind of respect that he was held in. And I had dealings with Pape and I absolutely loved him, like everybody who knew him far better than I did, but a very humble man, one of the greatest talkers ever. This man spoke beautifully, and a huge figure of authority, and so much more for French and for African football in general. So Michel Hidalgo, Pape Diouf, rest in peace.
That's a lovely tribute, Philippe. Finally, moving on from last week's pods, watching classic games, off the back of the 1973 Cup Final, Jonathan Wilson tweeted that Dennis Chewett rang him up, and the first words before he'd even said hello were, "It was never a penalty." So that's that sorted. Ken says, just now watching Leeds v Sunderland, only been watching soccer since 2006, brackets, I'm American. And the next two words were, holy hell, they are chopping each other down every play. It's a yellow every other a minute and a red every five. Marcus says, Sunderland Till I Die 2 has been out on Netflix for all of 30 hours. I want a full review from Barry.
Well, I wrote a piece on it last Saturday, which is available on the Guardian website. And I interviewed Charlie Methven, who's sort of the Brentian character in it. He's an old Etonian with a fondness for wearing burgundy trousers. So he was a bit of a fish out of water at the Stadium of Light and at the training ground. I found him quite affable, I have to say, but he is getting a lot of criticism on social media, I've noticed, in the past 24 hours. If for anyone who hasn't watched Sunderland Till I Die, this is a second series. First series chronicled their... It was kind of a vanity project by the then chairman, Martin Bain, and he came out of it looking very badly, and he's since left the club. Charlie Methven and Stuart Donald took over. Methven has since left the club. He was sort of executive chief executive, whatever, but he left for family reasons in the time-honored tradition. I think he'd upset a few fans with some of his rather blunt talk, but I'll be honest, the two do come across as slightly buffoonish, particularly Methven, but I do think they had the best interests of the club at heart. I will say that. I could be wrong, but that's my impression. But it is compelling viewing just to watch this shit show. I mean, in the second series, it chronicles a season in which they fail to get... They lose two Wembley finals, one of them a playoff final, and finish in the lowest league position in the club's history, and that's comparatively brilliant compared to the season before. So that kind of tells you all you need to know.
There was a nice message below the line from Dave, who's on lockdown in Bologna. I can't read it all out because it was about 3,000 words, but at the end he says, since hearing Baz describe eating a banana as putting rocket fuel in a car a few years ago, I have never been able to enjoy one in quite the same way again. Keep well, all of you, we need you. Stuart says, now that Barry has fixed his microphone, more saucy lyric readings to end the pod. Have you noticed that Clive Tilsley has stolen your thunder, Barry, and is now on Instagram doing spoken word songs in a tuxedo?
I was unaware of that, but I shall seek it out because I'm...
There you are. You're a pioneer, Barry.
I did notice that Clive was doing sort of at-home commentaries on his wife cooking dinner or him and his wife eating dinner. I was lucky enough to meet Clive and Mrs. Tilsley. I make her sound like Gail from Coronation Street here, but at some function or other. And his wife is a great laugh. She is a lovely lady. So
they're good people. The Tilsleys are good people. That's the truth.
Good peoples.
So anyway, Sid Lowe asked when he was on last week if you would read out the lyrics to La Bamba to finish the podcast. And so that's how we'll finish the podcast. Philippe, thanks so much for coming on. No doubt we'll get you on again very soon.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Philippe. Merci.
De rien.
Now, Barry Glendening reads La Bamba.
Parabaya La Bamba. Parabaya La Bamba. Se necesita una poca de gracia. Un poca de gracia. Para mi, para ti, arriba, arriba. Ayariba Ariba, Portisere, Vono soy marinero, yo no soy marinero, soy capitán, bamba, bam. Parabaya la bamba, se necesita un poco de gracia para mí, para ti, Ayariba.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.